Okay, this is Yanni Chapman on Tuesday, May 4th or 5th, 2009. And I'm continuing to do my autobiographical sketches. And the last time, we've been focusing on, I've been focusing on political socialization, political development. And the last time I got up through high school and talked about my experiences on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation and tutoring at Caramu House and some of those things. But I think I've been reflecting a little bit, and I believe that I need to go back into my childhood more, and particularly my middle school years, I think, and develop some themes that, are very personal on the one hand, but very much part of my political development on the other. And so actually the place I'll start is talking just a little bit about the work that I did to try to understand the development of the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill. And I quickly found out as I started doing interviews and reading and talking to people that there was a particular group of young men, high school age young men, who organized the first sit-in in Chapel Hill, and who many of them continued to be very prominent in the movement throughout its history from 1960 through 1964. And in interviewing some of them, like James Britton and Thomas Mason, who were 15 years old in 1960, and Harold Foster, who was probably 17 or 18 in 1960, as well as interviewing Gloria Williams, and that's Thomas Mason's sister. Originally she was Gloria Mason, and some other people. It became clear, I mean, I asked the question, why was it that certain of the black youth stepped forward to initiate and lead the struggle, and others didn't? And why did the leadership of the struggle come from high school students instead of, say, from older, more established black members of the community, like teachers and preachers, business people, who often did become part of the movement, but they did not initiate it or take the lead. And it was the young people who carried the leadership throughout. And, you know, one theme I found was that there were certain characteristics of a generation that came of age came into being like 12 years old or so around the time of the beginnings of the civil rights movement, you know, with Brown versus Board of Education and the Montgomery bus boycott and some of those events that occurred before 1960. And so I traced the generational aspect. And certainly, in my own case, I would say also that my political development and my thinking about the world had a great deal to do with coming of age at a certain point in history where many of these issues that I've become devoted to, you know, throughout my life were being raised in various parts of the world and in the U.S. in very strong and prominent ways that created an environment where it was easier for me and many others to realize that these issues were out there and to get a feel for them and to feel that if we participated in, say, the civil rights struggle, that we weren't the only ones. There were lots of people who were doing this. And the other thing that I had to figure out with the young people in Chapel Hill was not only why this particular generation, but why these particular young people, why were they the ones who took the lead? And what I found was that in pretty much every case, each one of these young people had developed a rebellious personality from a young age. Now, that rebellious personality was not necessarily political to begin with. It took various forms, and the same thing happened with me, but I'll talk about the young people in Chapel Hill. Not only did they develop rebellious personalities, but that included being critical thinkers and being people who didn't necessarily accept the norms of society, of their society, and didn't necessarily want to jump through the hoops that you needed to jump through in order to be considered, a young, upstanding black person. So what that meant concretely was that, let's say, Harold Foster, who became the leader of the movement through much of its history and had a great influence on it. He had two sisters, and they were all raised by their mother, Hattie B. Foster, and she, his father, he didn't see very much, and he was primarily raised by his mother. The thing about Hattie B. Foster was that she was a fairly poor woman. She wasn't part of the group in Chapel Hill of black people who Harold referred to as the people who had. She had a low-wage job. She didn't own her own house. And as a single parent, obviously, she struggled to make ends meet. But Hattie B. Foster was also a community activist. So one of the things that these young people who developed into leaders in the movement also grew up, along with their rebellious personalities, they often had a history as of leaders. Now, it might have been leaders in sports, or leaders in getting into trouble, or leaders in thinking in a different way, or doing things that other kids didn't do. But Hattie B. Foster was a community leader, and she worked with the NAACP and many other organizations. And she and Harold, she taught Harold a lot. She would talk to Harold about things like the differences within the black community, between light-skinned and dark-skinned, between the people who had and the people who didn't. In other words, she explained things like class and color consciousness to Harold. And Harold himself was one of the black kids who get outside of the black community. That was not particularly common. He had a paper route, so he went all over the community delivering newspapers. And he learned a lot about all the different people in different parts of town, and so on and so forth. At a certain point, Harold felt betrayed by his mother, and then he went into a stage of rebellion against her. And it carried over into other kinds of rebellion. He became part of a group of young male friends who went where they weren't supposed to go and did the things that they weren't supposed to do, and just sort of pushed the envelope to see how much they could get away with. And this group of young men, this group of friends, certainly wasn't any kind of a gang, but it was a group. And as Thomas Mason and James Britton explained it to me, and some others, this was a group of people, of young men, who were very smart. But they didn't win all the awards at school for academic excellence because they didn't have any interest in jumping through all the hoops and doing the work that was required, the kind of work that was required to be an outstanding student. And I was told by several of them that they could have taken all these awards, but they really weren't that interested. Many of them were also leaders in athletics. Harold was a quarterback on a football team, and you know, various things like that. They culturally rebelled in various ways. One of the things that this group of young men did was several of them, James Britton and Harold and some others, I think, got a subscription to Downbeat magazine. I believe it was Downbeat, but it was a jazz magazine. And jazz was sort of kind of music that represented a certain kind of rebellion, or free thinking, or something. Not that many other black kids were listening to jazz and reading jazz magazines. And several of them, including Harold, also quit the black church. Harold was at Reverend Manley's First Baptist Church. And he would get in philosophical arguments with Reverend Manley, and eventually he quit the church, which was really a fairly shocking thing to do. And so these young men developed these rebellious personalities with leadership qualities, with critical thinking. And as the years went by, their talk and their thinking turned more and more toward civil rights and political issues. So that, for instance, James Britton and Thomas Mason I'm not sure if it was in 1958 or a little bit later, but the Cuban Revolution had happened, and one of them, or both of them, spoke up in class. I think that there was something going on at the university about the Cuban Revolution. They spoke up in class at Lincoln High School and said, well, you know, I mean, this was an age of anti-communism and everything, right? But they said, well, maybe there's something good about the Cuban Revolution, because the U.S. government seems to really disapprove of it, and the U.S. government also helps to oppress black people, so maybe we've got something in common with the Cubans. And as a result of that, they got suspended from school for 2 weeks. Now the schools were black schools with black teachers and black principal. But the school board was white, and so the school superintendent was white. And there was a whole variety of trouble and incidents that these young men got into as a result of the kind of political pressure that existed in the black schools to not challenge white authority. And so Mr. McDougall was the principal. And, you know, the norms of white society, including anti-communism and so forth, were ingrained into a lot of people. And certainly the fear of making the wrong impression and getting into trouble was particularly acute for black people. You know, if you were black in Chapel Hill, you couldn't afford to seem to be unpatriotic or to speak out against white people or racism or any of those kinds of things. And here these young kids were starting to do it, and that probably posed a threat to not only the white superintendent, but the black authorities, who felt like they had to protect their institutions. And the only way to do that was to go along to a significant extent with what white people wanted. In any case, they all ended up being leaders of the civil rights movement. And because although it's very important to acknowledge that the black schools, such as Lincoln High School, were nurturing places for black youth, and their self-worth was bolstered in these schools, and they learned black history. But schools were also a place where there was a certain framework of thinking that was part of surviving in a white society. So the kinds of things that they learned about in terms of black history were to respect people like Booker T. Washington, who was a black man who made it up out of slavery to really make something of himself. And this was the example of a black person who made it in a white world. and Harold Foster and his friends, who had developed this ability to think critically and not be deferential to the norms of either black power or black institutional power or habit and white institutional power, talked among themselves and said, well, why are we studying about, you know, people who are honored because they made it in a white man's world? We should be asking the question of why is there a white man's world to begin with? And, you know, do we have to grow up in a white man's world? Can we change it? And so that's the kind of thinking that led to the civil rights movement. But that was critical thinking, that was challenging, that was thinking outside the box, that was resisting the norms of the community, just as going against Reverend Manley was going against the norms of the community. But this freed these young men to challenge authority, and in particular, segregationist authority. I'm going to pause for a second here and then come back. From the day I was born, I enjoyed race and gender privilege. I was white and I was male. Now, when I, during my first 11 months, when I was living on weekends with my mother at the camp at the YWCA in Oakland and living in a foster home during the week, I suppose that it's fair to say that I didn't enjoy much in the way of class privilege. although my mother's was impoverished and didn't have any wealth, she had come from a background of relative wealth and sophistication. So, nevertheless, from the day I was adopted by my great aunt, Celeste Chapman, who had been Celeste Lydia Beckwith, and by her husband, my father, who was Ralph Eddie Chapman, I also enjoyed class privilege because they were in a pretty good situation in a very upscale neighborhood. All of our neighbors and friends were well-to-do, and I went to a private school for boys and got a particularly elite education. So, interestingly, although my rebellion came in different forms, and my critical thinking and leadership also happened in somewhat different ways, I ended up using that critical thinking and rebellious personality and leadership ability to follow in the footsteps of Harold Foster and James Britton and Thomas Mason. If only in solidarity with them and the struggle for black freedom. And this was actually quite unusual among my cohort in Cleveland. You know, in my private school at Hawken, a lot of the young guys developed a certain amount of critical thinking, because that was one of the things that was emphasized in our education. And quite a few of them also developed leadership qualities. Not so many became truly rebellious. And for the most part, these young men went on to fairly traditional careers as businessmen and professionals, some academics, lots of doctors and lawyers. And there were very, very few that I ever found out about who did anything like really commit their lives to the struggle for justice, which does not mean that they didn't work for justice in their own way, in their jobs or in their lives. But as far as becoming organizers or movement builders, were taking things as far as I did. That was, except for a very few people that I knew about in all of the private schools in Cleveland, that was very unusual. And I've often wondered why I turned out differently. And I just think that it has a lot to do with my adoption and with some of the experiences that I had that other people didn't have, some of the Peter Relic experiences, the Caramu House, the high school exchanges, the Indian reservation. Of course, I was already on my way when I chose to do those things, but, you know, I started off to be a good paternalistic, noblesse oblige, liberal kind of person. But I guess the fact that there was a civil rights movement raging in the country during, my late middle school years and high school years. And then when I got to college, there was a big movement. That all helped me along, but it's a little bit hard to say exactly why I turned out the way I did. In any case, let me give you a sketch of some of the ways that I developed that I think led to my breaking with norms and rebelling and working for justice. And these, as I said, these things are also personal. So, for instance, the first thing I'm going to talk about is how my love of nature developed. And that was primarily because of my father. My father was really, really interested in science. He understood a whole lot, and he taught me a lot about the things that he knew. And he really enjoyed taking me out and opening up the natural world to me. So, for instance, I remember when I was a little kid out at Madison, I remember he woke me up out of bed one night, and he and my mother and I went outside to, we had these great big huge silver maple trees that lined the street, and on our property we had a number that were very big. And he brought a flashlight out, and we went down the street a little ways to one of those trees. And he showed me a Luna moth coming out of its cocoon. And it was emerging at night. It was a full moon night, I believe. And Luna moths are particularly striking. You don't see them all that often, but they're these great big pale green moths with sort of big long swallow tails. And, you know, they're about maybe 4 inches long. And we saw it come out all crinkled, and then very slowly it unwound its wings. And, you know, it was sitting there on the tree, on the bark of the tree, drying out its wings and getting prepared for its new life. And my dad explained to me that not only was it sitting there, seemingly doing nothing, but drying its wings, but it was also sending out pheromones. Probably the first time I had heard that word. And you know, I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And he explained that these were little scent molecules that the Luna moth could generate to find a mate, to allow other moths to find it. And so eventually what would happen would be that another Luna moth would come and find this one, and they would fly away and mate and have little babies or little eggs that would turn into little worms, and then they would spin webs after their little lives were over as worms, and they'd spin webs and go through metamorphosis and come out these wonderful, very pretty, short-lived moths. So he explained all that to me, and this was just like, you know, for a little kid, this was like beautiful. It was intriguing. It was interesting. It was just awe-inspiring. So then another time out at Madison, he woke me up out of bed, and we went out to the little garage that we had out back of Madison, which was packed full of tools, basically, like axes and lawnmowers and all kinds of stuff. And there was sort of a box out there that somehow a possum had got into and had its babies. And so he opened up the lid of the box and shone his flashlight down there on this possum mommy. And there was all these little mouse-shaped hairless things that were the babies. And the mommy hissed at us and snarled. And, you know, you could see that it had a mouthful of really sharp teeth. And my dad explained that they could be dangerous. And another thing that we did was we composted our garbage. And basically what that meant was that we'd take our melon rinds and our green bean snappings and various other things, and we'd put them in a paper bag, and my dad would dig this big hole. He had a post hole digger, and he would dig a big hole that was about a foot wide and it'd probably be about 5 feet deep. And it wasn't too hard to dig a hole like that because the soil in Madison was pretty much sand, not clay. And so he'd dig this hole, and then he'd toss in a bag of, you know, garbage, and then he'd cover it up with some dirt. And as it got up close to the top, one of the things that we realized was that there was some animal that was getting into this garbage and trying to eat some of it. because you'd see it spread around and you'd find animal tracks, and the tracks were raccoon tracks. I had a lot of raccoons out there. And so what my dad did is he took the kind of sand that the soil was made of, which was sort of this dark orangey sand, and he would put it he put it around the edge of the hole, and he would spread it very carefully so that it was very smooth, and for several feet around the hole there was no way you could get to the hole without walking through this sand. And so then what would happen would be we'd come out the next day and the raccoon had gotten into the garbage, or had tried to, and there would be raccoon tracks in the sand. And then my dad would mix up a bag of what he called plaster of Paris, which was sort of like this liquid pudding kind of thing. Only what happened was, he would pour it in molds on top of these tracks and then set it up so that it would harden. And it would harden, and then you'd take it out and brush the sand off of it, and you'd have these perfect raccoon tracks. So other things that my dad did with me, especially out at Madison, was he took me on bird walks. We had a bird book, and we would wander through the woods and try to identify different birds. And he identified all the different trees that grew out there. And one of the things that we did a lot of in Madison was we cut down trees, because we had a whole big field that was full of trees, and little by little, my dad and I, every summer, we would clear out some of the trees so that it could become more of a grassy yard. We didn't clear them all out, but so there were these different kinds of trees. Some of them were real big, and so we had elm trees, and we had different kinds of oak trees. We had maple trees. And one of the trees that I liked the best was the sassafras trees. And Madison was slowly developing, and so it turned out that there were a few lots across the street from us and nearby that people were going to build houses on. And they would hire this guy to cut down all the trees. And I forget what this guy's name was, but basically he cut them down with an axe. And he could really take big chunks out of a tree with one axe swing, a couple of axe swings. And so my dad and I would help him. And my dad was great with an axe. You know, we used axes all the time out in Madison. And we also used big handheld cross-cut saws to cut up wood. And we, instead of just cutting the trees off at the stump, we would dig around them and cut the roots with axes and little saws and things. And sometimes these trees were huge, and so we'd end up with a stump hole that was about like 6 or 7 feet across and 5 feet deep. And then we'd take a block and tackle and attach it to the tree and connect it to some other tree farther away. And then we'd use this block and tackle and slowly just pull the tree over and out of the ground. And then we'd cut it up and get rid of it and burn it for firewood, or I don't know what we did with the elm because it didn't burn very good. Put it in a pile someplace. And so anyways, those kinds of activities, I was cutting up a lot of wood. And so when you cut wood, with a saw, you learn that different kinds of trees have a different look when you cut them. Some have certain, you know, some are dark brown like walnut, some are yellow like Osage orange, some are pretty much white like maple or beech, some are sort of gray or tan like elm, and then the oak trees were different kinds, you know, red oak, black oak, white oak. And not only did they look different, but they each had a different smell. And the sassafras trees in particular, they were very light-colored wood on the inside, but they had this wonderful smell. And the leaves had the smell, too. You know, you could take the leaves off and let them dry, and then we made sassafras tea out of them. And you could, if you dug them up, you could clean the roots, and then you could peel off the outer bark of the roots, and you could boil that, and it would make sort of a kind of syrup that tasted sort of like root beer, which is, I think, apparently how root beer was made to begin with. So what this all comes down to is that, first of all, I learned to not just see the outside of things, the surface of things, but rather realize that there was an internal structure and there were processes that went on within the tree, like growth and rotting and all kinds of things. And that, you know, the structure of the tree was very carefully designed. Anyways, it very carefully followed the laws of physics so that it would make the tree strong in certain ways. And the roots, you know, had to be of a certain size to support a tree of a certain size. You know, you learned all these things. You sort of started instead of, you know, you started by just knowing a tree by its bark and its leaves and stuff, and you just looked at it, and there it was, and it was like a snapshot. Superficial, static, so on and so forth. This is the metaphysical view of life, as Marx would put it. And then as you really started actually trying to change the tree, you learned all of its properties, or you learned some of its properties anyway. So you learned not only its structure, but some of the internal dynamics of growth and decline. And so, and you'd watch tree grows when I was a little kid, and then I remember trees grew, and they were great big trees by the time I was 15. So I learned to see critically, to think critically, beyond just the surface of things or the static image of things at a certain point in time. And this is fundamental to critical thinking. And it's also fundamental to science, because science, as opposed to the dogma and faith that are basic to most religions, instead of trying to, you know, basically accept the world as it is, science is about changing the world and learning about the world through changing it. So that, for instance, if folks want to learn the structure of an atom, they try to change the atom by bombarding it with other particles. And then they see what it breaks up into and into its constituent parts and all the various little electrons, protons, neutrons, and all kinds of little particles and rays and energy and all that stuff. Religion isn't like that. You know, back in the old days of the Renaissance, people started challenging the dogma of religion about how God created the world in 7 days, and you know, the whole world, the whole universe revolved around man and was static. And these astronomers, you know, started observing the planets and realizing that the universe was not man-centered. And this, of course, upset the church, and the church tried to repress this knowledge and, you know, banned books and burned people at the stake and excommunicated them and did all this repressive stuff because they didn't like this way of dealing with the world. It threatened the power of the church. And later on, maybe I'll talk about religion more. I mean, I certainly don't think that spirituality and science are contradictory. I do think that most religious dogma and religious thinking is contradictory to science, and I don't believe it. I do accept religions as expressions of human needs and aspirations and history and so on and so forth. And I think that religion is like everything else. It's full of contradiction. And so oftentimes mainstream religion is very hierarchical and repressive, at least nowadays. It may not have been that way back before society itself was hierarchical and repressive, back when there was no big cities or towns and people lived as hunter-gatherers and there was no surplus, and so therefore there was no private property. But there were different religions at that time that helped people make sense of their world and gave them a sense of control over things. And I think that's what, you know, religions do. They reflect the actual social structure of society, and they serve in various ways to help people deal with all that. But in religions, like I said, there might be a dominant mainstream religion that is promoted and supported by the dominant mainstream groups in society, those with power and privilege, the ruling class. And then there's oppositional religions aspects of, say, Christianity, so that you have, for instance, in Latin America, where there are so many poor people, there's brands of Catholicism or ways of interpreting Catholicism that have come to be known as liberation theology. And that reflects more the culture of resistance against social domination. And then in the United States, Black people developed Christianity as an oppositional brand of Christianity to the mainstream white dominant dogma and religion, which preached that slavery was ordained by God and so on and so forth. That's a little bit about how I feel about religion. So anyways, I can, on a human level, I definitely can identify with all of those aspects of religion that are about resistance to domination. And I think those kinds of trends within religions exist in all religions, not just Christian. So anyways, back to my love of nature. My dad also in Cleveland, he had an electronics shop in the basement, and a metalworking shop, and a woodworking shop. He used to be a photographer, so he had an unused photo studio. So my dad had all these different kind of projects going on all the time, and I was his constant buddy. That's who I spent my time hanging out with while I was little. And he would constantly teach me how to do things in the shop, do metalworking, particularly woodworking. And he would try to teach me about electronics and radio and diodes and tubes and all this kind of stuff, which I didn't understand so well. He would teach me about electricity and gravity and thermodynamics and, you know, again, it was always the way you come to understand something is to change it, try to change it. You know, you understand the properties of a metal when you try to change it. My dad and I did blacksmithing, so we came to understand some of the properties of steel and iron by heating it up and pounding it with a hammer and learning some of these different properties and how you can temper it or soften it, either way, harden it or soften it. And, you know, he would give me science books and little experimental things. He gave me a steam engine once, which I never used too much. But, you know, it helped me understand that the way you understand the properties of water is by changing it. So one way to change it is heating it. Another way is by cooling it. If you cool it, you end up with ice. And that's a certain form of water. It's still water, but it's in a different form. If you heat it, you end up with boiling and steam. That's also water, but it's a different form. And it was obvious to me that these changes that took place didn't happen simply just gradually, but at a certain point when you kept adding degrees and degrees and degrees of temperature, then at a certain point something big happened and the water boiled and turned into steam. It wasn't just gradual, it was the accumulation of small changes. And then there was a revolutionary transformation. And I later came to understand when I studied Marxism that that is, you know, part of the law of dialectics, how things change, the process of change, and how contradiction is central to that. And I won't go into that, but it was easy to accept Marxist dialectics. And materialism and historical materialism after growing up with science. So, and my mother, and we did stars and stuff. We'd take the telescope out and we'd look at Mars when it came close to Earth. And actually, the telescope quality wasn't very good, so that was sort of disappointing. But we'd go out and look at shooting stars, and we'd go out and look at the Aurora Borealis. So I just loved science, and I was a science freak in school up until about ninth grade. And I wanted to be a scientist. My dad took me fossil collecting and rock collecting and all that kind of thing. My mother, on the other hand, didn't talk much about science, but what she did do was instill a love of words and literature in me, because first of all, she read to me every single night for all the years that I can remember, as long as I was, you know, little. And we'd read all kinds of different things. And then I would get older, and we had this huge library, and I would pull out all these books and encyclopedias and stuff. And I would just, you know, this was not my own direct experience, but it was secondary experience through the eyes of others. And so I would read all about different kinds of things. I knew all about different kinds of religion and different societies and different kinds of people and different ages in history. I knew about geological time and, you know, the different periods of geological history and also of human history. And this was sort of even before I studied any of these things in school. So my mother also wrote plays and poetry, and she would write particularly for the church, and she would write these very witty poems that she would then read at church programs, you know, and they'd be about the minister or the congregation or some kind of thing that was going on. And she wrote plays or helped direct plays, church plays. And of course, I would always have to be in those. So I learned things like how to project my voice and do public speaking and be on stage. And I learned a lot about writing and a lot about literature. And so this totally broadened my experience and gave me all kinds of training, which then I built upon when I went into school. Now, one of the things that happened, I think, as a result of this fairly broad knowledge and my basic orientation as a scientist, was that, of course, my mother was very religious, and we went to church every Sunday at the Episcopal Church in Shaker Heights. And for a variety of reasons, I started questioning the church, probably in seventh or eighth grade. And I think part of those reasons had to do with the particular congregation and kind of church that I was in Shaker Heights, which, you know, you would call it business Episcopalianism. It wasn't high Episcopal, which was like Catholics with a lot of ceremony and so forth. It was low, which meant it was much more informal. But all of the people who attended this church were all the same people who lived around me in the neighborhood. And they all wore suits and ties. The men wore suits and ties, and the women wore dresses. And the congregation was fairly old. There was a youth group that I was a leader in. And in particular, I sang in the church choir starting in about seventh or eighth grade. And I just simply loved singing. I could sing really well. I had a soprano voice. It was a soprano male choir. So they trained our voices. And we had these two choir directors, Paul Beamer and Warren Miller. And Paul Beamer was older. Warren Miller was younger. Paul Beamer was sort of a little bit wizened. And Warren Miller was a little bit chubby. And they both had tremendous tempers and would, you know, unleash it on anybody in the choir who didn't pay attention or made bad mistakes or messed things up. And Paul Beamer was the organist and pianist in the church, and Warren Miller directed the choir. But they both were involved in our choir practices, which we had, I think, at least once or twice a week. So I didn't know it at the time, but it turned out that they were a gay couple, and they had this huge house in Brattonall, which was a suburb of Cleveland. And every 4th of July, they would invite all the choir boys over for a sleepover. And we would do fireworks and have food and just have a great time. And we all slept in this sort of dormitory-style situation, which they set up, I guess, cots in this huge living room that they had. And one of their eccentricities was that they were clock collectors. And so, first of all, the house was an old steam-heated house. And so, if we went there in the wintertime, there would be all these pipes cracking and making noise all night long, just from the expansion and contraction of the steam. And the second thing is that all the time, every hour, there would be about 20 or 30 clocks that chimed and made different kinds of noises. So it was a little bit hard to get any sleep there, but we had a great time. And like I said, although I learned later on that they were gay, they never, you know, let on, and they never bothered anybody that I knew of. So somewhere along the line when I got older, I sort of learned about that from my mother, I believe. And it was interesting reflecting back later that the church, you know, obviously knew they were gay. All the members knew they were gay and tolerated that just fine. These guys certainly didn't flaunt their gayness in church. But I started, even though I loved the choir and I loved the social youth group at church and all that, I started questioning religion. And that was partly because of this big social movement, the civil rights movement that was going on. And the thing that I noticed was that my church was all white, and it didn't seem as though anybody cared about civil rights. And this sort of pissed me off. So that was one way in which I became concerned about my own particular church congregation. But then, of course, my mother had had me baptized when I was like 13 or 14, and I went through this whole series of classes to prepare for being, not baptized, but what do you call it? I don't know, it's not communion. It's getting ready to where you can start taking communion. And I did that, and then later on, maybe around ninth grade, I started thinking that was really sneaky of my mother to do that and of the church to do that before I got old enough to really make these choices for myself, and I hadn't really thought things through. And so that made me very angry. And then I would go to these church camps and church retreats, and I was the leader of the youth group and all of that. And there were a variety of ministers, some young ministers who were at these camps. And I would talk with them. I had deep conversation about religion with them. And, you know, so I had this science background, and I thought basically that everything had to, you know, exist in nature and be demonstrable. Otherwise, there was no reason to believe in it. And secondly, I had this sort of wide reading knowledge. I knew about different religions. And I also had read in high school, maybe before high school, maybe seventh grade or so, books like Albert Camus, who was very skeptical of religion, like many Europeans after World War II, and, you know, asked the question, is if the world is so horrible and these terrible things like war and genocide go on, does that mean that God permits these things or endorses them, or is this God's will, or is this really not anything to do with God? Maybe it demonstrates that God doesn't exist or that God is not a just God. So I had all these thoughts, and I had all these conversations with these preachers. I was leader of the youth group. And I had a very, you know, wrenching experience where I came to believe that religion was phony. That was the word we used in the 60s. And that all of this stuff about, I mean, the crowning straw that broke the camel's back was when I asked this young preacher, you know, I don't see anything in the world that causes me to believe that I cannot just live just fine with my own values and not worry about God. And I don't see any demonstration of God's existence in the world. It's true I don't understand everything about how the world started and all that, and it does seem to work in a very organic, functioning kind of way. But maybe that's just science. Maybe that's not God. And basically what he said to me, he says, there's no way to prove that God exists. There's no way to demonstrate it in the ways that you want. You simply have to take a leap of faith. And I found that totally unacceptable. So basically I got up in youth group and I quit the church. And I stayed in the choir because I liked to sing, but I didn't say the prayers and I didn't go along with all of the kneeling and protocol. And, you know, after a while I just stopped going to church. So all of this was part of learning to think outside the box, to think critically, to not defer to constituted authority. I lost respect for the older people in the community, partly because of the civil rights thing, partly because it was clear to me that the preachers you know, not only were not pursuing civil rights, but really couldn't answer my questions. The business people obviously weren't on target. And in particular, I had fights with my mother, and so all of these ideas about deferring to, you know, the normal authorities, you know, teachers and parents and preachers and politicians and leaders and so forth, pretty much I threw all that out. And I thought, the only way I'm going to respect anyone is if they earn respect. And to earn respect, you know, you have to be a person who is honest and truthful, you know, works for justice and helps people. And those are really my main criteria. So all this developed while I was in high school. And then I went to the Indian reservation and I started learning about the real condition of real people who were oppressed and the real history of groups that were oppressed. And I learned that all of this knowledge had been censored and suppressed by the media, by the newspapers and so forth, by the movies, by the politicians, by my parents, by everybody. So I felt totally betrayed. That's probably the best word, betrayed. And I had been living in a bubble in Shaker Heights and had no sense of what the world was really like and had been basically living a lie. And that was pretty much the kind of attitude that I went into college with. And part of what was going on in all of this was my own personal rage. I had a lot of rage. I was full of anger. I learned to control it in various ways. But particularly when I would start fighting with my mother, which happened because in ninth grade, my split with the church and my starting to date Charlene DiNardo, who was Catholic, and my mother's attempt to control my life just infuriated me. And I saw no justice in it, and I saw no reason why I should go along with it other than that I was dependent on my family for transportation and money and so forth. And I did want to go to a good college, so, you know, I had to make certain kinds of concessions. But the fights I had with my mother became increasingly vicious, and she was a person who was indomitable and very strong-willed and very outspoken, certainly not like the traditional women that you saw on television. And she was involved in public affairs and all of that. But I just became extremely angry with her because I felt like she was showing me off to her friends. She was using me. She felt like she had invested in me, and therefore I should return the investment with interest. I thought of her as, as not really being able to see me or really care about me and nurture me. But I knew she loved me. But there were just all these things that I resented. And I think I had a lot of rage because of my early childhood experiences of being shipped around back and forth every week. No constant parenting, no father in the picture. and then all of a sudden, given up for adoption. And I didn't know about it at the time. I didn't understand it. But I had had this experience in my life where I got totally abandoned by my mother and left with this other family. And the other family was very good people in many, many ways, and they loved me and they nurtured me as best they could. But they happened to be old, and they happened to have various prejudices and narrowness. I got pluses and minuses out of all of that, but I had this tremendous rage. And I feel like I pretty much had to protest in my life. That was a necessity. And so, I really lost all respect for my mother. And I bitterly attacked her and, pointed out all of her flaws and the things that I thought she was doing wrong in terms of dealing with me and my father. I hated the way she dealt with my father. She acted like she had saved him, and was sort of his savior. because he was weak and he was sick and so forth back in the 1940s when she married him. And they had been longtime friends, but as far as I could tell, there was no romantic love, although he always called her Trish, which stood for treasure, and he seemed totally devoted to her. So I think there was something there, but the way she treated him, I really didn't like. She nagged him to get all kinds of things done. He did all this stuff around the house, but he couldn't handle her nagging, and he would just retreat down into the basement or into the library to his chair and his books. And he wouldn't speak up for himself. You know, while my grandmother was alive, he probably felt it wasn't his place, it wasn't his house, so on and so forth. But I just totally resented all that. And so when I came to college, I had this tremendous rage that I wasn't totally aware of, and this rebellious spirit. And when I got to college, I mean, I looked forward to Harvard because I thought it would give me the best possible education. And it was in the thick of... was in the thick of things. It wasn't isolated like Dartmouth or some other schools. It was right in the middle of a big city, and that was where things were happening. And so I really had very high expectations for Harvard education. And I got to Harvard my first year, and of course, all of a sudden, I had to deal with the fact that I was no longer the smartest or strongest or anything else. Both of my roommates, Bob Bush and Bill Blanding, had gotten 800s on their SATs. I had only gotten in the 700s. So they were obviously smarter than me. And I played soccer on the freshman team. But many of the players were foreign, and they obviously had skills vastly superior to mine. So that was sort of a big come down, because I'd always been the big soccer star. I didn't even think about going out for baseball, because I didn't feel like I had anything close to what it would take to be a college baseball player. All of these things were sort of knocked me down a notch or two and made me doubt myself in some ways. But the thing that really, really, really upset me was the quality of the teachers. And I took all these classes my first year with famous professors, Bernard Balin in history, He ended up being a senator from someplace. Anyways, they were presidential advisors on urban policy, and you know, Balin was pretty smart, and his classes were really pretty intriguing and good. Except for the fact that he was totally opposed to any kind of economic or social analysis of the American Revolution. The way he presented it, it was all about ideas. It was about the ideology of the day. And these documents that we read were the various tracts that people had written about liberty and so on and so forth. And when one of the graduate students in the class brought up issues of class and race and so forth, he just got totally slapped down. And so I didn't have too much respect for Bernard Balin. Yeah, and these advisors to presidents about urban policy, I thought they were just so incredibly boring and full of shit. It was incredible. And I actually found a lot of the Harvard professors to be totally out to lunch, irrelevant to what was going on in the world, and just boring. So this actually produced sort of a crisis for me, because I had had all these wonderful high expectations for education at Harvard, and here it turned out that the professors weren't really very good in a lot of ways, not for undergraduate students anyways. And they were famous, but so what? Again, so I lost respect for that kind of thing. And of course, the graduate students were another matter. They were really good. They were really sharp. They were with it, usually. And the students were incredibly sharp and diverse, and I just learned most of what I learned from them. But I didn't get involved in politics much those first couple of years of college. I just sort of played soccer and went to parties and dated and, you know, did my academic work. At some point, I did venture into the community to do a paper on urban development, and there was a big controversy called the Interbelt Controversy. And there was actually some person who became a famous right-wing politician who was leading the struggle, I think, against the Interbelt. And so I started learning about, like, local politics and what the real world was like outside of Harvard. And that helped me move along. But I think what I'll do is end here for today. And when I come back, I'll talk about some of my experiences that opened up my mind about things that had to do with the movement that was developing right under my nose in Cambridge and around the country, and also the presence of radicals at Harvard and how they presented themselves and created situations that caused all of us to think about which side were we on. And then that eventually led to my big-time involvement in SDS in 1969. So we'll end it here, and I'll be back again. Bye.